You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
I wanna be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I wanna be a producer.
Hey guys, if you're a subscriber to this podcast, and why wouldn't you be? Do me a favor and get on over to iTunes and give us a big, fat, juicy, favorable review, will ya? It'll help spread the word about Broadway and all these incredible artists that we've had on as guests. Thank you so much.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hello, producers, prospective podcast listeners. Welcome back to the show. We are towards the end of Spring Awakening month here on the podcast. Of course, we've had our director, we've had both of our authors, and today we welcome to the show the choreographer of Spring Awakening, as well as the choreographer of So You Think You Can Dance, Dancing with the Stars, the Emmy-nominated Mr. Spencer Liff. Welcome, Spencer.
Thank you for that introduction.
It's my game show intro. So, to give you an idea of how hot Spencer is as a choreographer, I'm going to tell you a little story. So, we're putting up the billboard of Spring Awakening the other day, and we're on the corner of like 45th and Broadway. And my partner and I, we look up, and of course, it's surrounded by all these other billboards. And my partner says to me, "Hey, look at those three big shows on our corner. What do they have in common?" And I said, "I don't know." And he said, "They were all choreographed by Spencer." Those three shows were Spring Awakening, of course, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, and the brand new Neil Patrick Harris variety show, Best Time Ever, which just made its debut on NBC last week. Spencer has been busy shooting that show while we're in preview, so he's one of the busiest guys around. So we're going to get straight to it. So tell me about the path, about how you've become a choreographer. You were an actor in the back in the day, yes?
I started very young. I went on the first national tour of the Will Rogers Follies. I was 7 years old, so I've been an equity member since I was seven, and got introduced to Tommy Toon at that age. And I think as the first director choreographer to work with, that was very inspiring. I always knew that that is the path I would take. So I became a dancer. I made my Broadway debut in Big the Musical when I was 10 years old. And just spent my childhood working, going back and forth between L.A. and New York in, you know, commercials, TV, national tours, Broadway, kind of all of that. And there wasn't ever a question that I would try anything else. That was just what I was going to do for my whole life. And as an adult, I started my dance career on Broadway and worked with a guy named Rob Ashford, and absolutely loved how he choreographed, how he worked. I became his assistant for several years, moved up to associate, and just learned as much as I could from him, as well as assisting sort of the other big Broadway choreographers at the time. And then I made a huge leap onto So You Think You Can Dance when I was 23, and that was really the first thing I had ever choreographed on my own, was on the biggest dance television show at the time. So it was a giant step forward, and it went very well, and I immediately knew that I had the opportunity to either really launch into the choreography career or to stay in my dancing career, and I made the choice to stop performing full-time and to really focus on the choreography.
And how old are you now, may I ask?
I just turned 30.
Just turned 30. There's an awful lot of that career already.
It was two very separate lives. It was my child performing career and then my adult performing career, which really was only from 18 to 23, and then now the choreography career.
So you started at 7. I assume you started dancing when you were...
4.
4 years old. Where are you from?
I am from Arizona.
You want to give the dance school a shout out?
I didn't really have one. I trained kind of all over the place in Arizona, but because I went on tour so young, I really learned how to dance at Broadway Dance Center in New York City, and some great schools in LA. But I had the fortune of getting to train from the best teachers in the world between LA and New York. That made a huge difference, and my mom was incredible at making sure that I was able to take from everybody. I went to School of American Ballet here in New York for a while as well.
So you mentioned that you always knew you wanted to choreograph. What was it about it that drew you towards it? And how were you, like, really young when you were like, oh, I want to make up steps, I want to do that? Or did it come later?
No, it started with... A lot of it started with pattern making. Like, this sounds so strange, but I would sit in the backyard and make patterns with the rocks that I would find and organize them and do formations with them. And I didn't even know what that was, but my brain just clicked into that. I could sit for hours and do that. Of course, my parents were like, fine, great, he's off on his own. But I would, the first show I saw was Cats, and I came back. My father took me on a trip to New York, and we saw Cats and as well as a few other shows. And I came back and had bought the tape then of it, and I did a performance of Cats for my mother every single day until she couldn't stand it anymore and put me in dance class. But I would sit and watch the movie musicals for hours, and I loved them. And I think I really knew, when I was in Big, I would watch Susan Stroman, and in my head, not in a disrespectful way, I would fix all the things I wanted to with the numbers, and I would think, like, this is how I would choreograph it, and I would put this moment in, and we should be doing this. And I knew instantly, I was like, I cannot wait till I'm in charge so I can do this. And that's, I just sort of knew that that's what it would be.
So the key to a choreographer's career is playing with rocks as a kid.
I know how strange that sounds, but I do have memories of just like, of seeing how patterns would flow with each other. And I would take the ones that looked alike and put them together and also, you know, all sorts of things. In Arizona, you don't have grass, so you have rocks.
That's very interesting though, because I'd never thought of it that way. I always think of choreography as this purely artistic form of expression, but there's a lot of organization and almost like these patterns and an OCD type of how you fit everything together.
Yeah, it's my brain doesn't now. Some people really chart everything out on paper. That doesn't do much for me anymore. Every once in a while, I'll grab like pennies and do it on a table when you're trying to figure out how to make, you know, a huge number work. Sometimes I do these award shows. And I did the Latin Grammys this year with like 65 people, and you have to figure out how all those bodies fit on stage, what the camera's going to look like from afar. And, you know, it is like almost like charting a football game in terms of X's and O's on paper sometimes.
Where do you start when you are told you're joining a new musical and you say, okay, we have this big production number here? What is your first step in terms of composing a dance for a show?
If it is within a musical and it's not just a standalone number, your first question is, what is it serving to the show? Where do we need to finish at the end of the number that we haven't, you know, learned before it? So you're just like a song, you're putting forth information. And so that's my beginning, is just sort of, you know, what we have to convey with the characters. And then really music is the next step. And I can listen to a song, and I just listen to it several times with my eyes closed. And by the end of that, I've composed it in my head as to what each section is. This is a dance break. This is when the guys dance. This is when the girls join them. This is when we all get around the lead singer and we lift him up. And so that sort of forms itself first. And then for me, the very last thing that falls into place are the actual steps. Those come really easy once the structure of everything else is figured out. In something like Spring Awakening, every single number really has to serve a different purpose, and it had to introduce a brand new idea so we could, you know, keep things flowing and use the sign language in a different way, which, you know, I'm sure we'll talk more about later. But, you know, on something like So You Think You Can Dance, where I am just putting forth a number, like a standalone number, I really will just sit and listen to music for hours and compare music and ideas and match them. And I get that light bulb aha moment, and then I'm like, okay, this is what I'm doing this week.
And how much do you work with a dance arranger when you're doing the composition of a new number? Do you rely on them to give you music? Do you say, here's what I want here?
I mean, the best ones is when it's a nice marriage. There are some, like David Chase, who is the best in the business in my mind. He comes up with his structure and then watches your dancers. And when there's a kick, he'll put in a ding. And when there's a lift, there's a music that matches it. There's nothing more beautiful than the first time you see the orchestra with the dancers and you see how it all comes together. And then I don't have a problem going to those dance arrangers and saying, I need 12 more counts here, or I need this to go ba-da-bum-bong. And they, you know, their brains work in that genius way that I don't understand, and they make it happen. And that's actually one of my favorite relationships in a room when you're creating something brand new, is, you know, when the composer is willing to play with you to make something really, really cool.
And how much do you rely on the dancers? I know directors, of course, when they are working on scenes, they'll say, oh, improvise this or try this or what do you think? And the actors will give them ideas. Do you do the same when you work with dancers? Do you say, what could you do here? Or are you like, here's what I want and this is how I want it? Or do they sometimes just freeform?
No, it's a good mix. It depends on what you're working on. I mean, in Spring Awakening, I don't have a lot of actual trained dancers in that show. So if we needed to move from one side of the stage to the other, we spent a lot of time. Every single morning I would put them through a rigorous warm-up. We would do strength work and core work, and then we would improv across the floor. And over the time I've spent with them, I just honed in on things that they did that I really liked so I could pull from their talents. When you work with great dancers, though, they all come with their own bag of tricks. And you can, you know, I'm not a big fan of just improv here, because that sort of is a little lazy on my part to do that. But you find yourself saying all the time, what is a lift you know how to do? I need you to do a turn into a big jump. And you do pull from their repertoire. It's really cool when things organically form in a room. And when you hire the best dancers or performers that you can get, you should give them the ability to bring forth what they have.
So I got a call the other day from a very successful Broadway producer who said, I want to come see Spring Awakening because I want to check out Spencer Liff and his style. Describe, if someone asked you what your style was, what would you say?
That's a hard question, because I don't want to be boxed in by one style. And I keep picking shows that are incredibly different from each other. I think you can easily recognize what my hyper dance style is on the TV show. In the theater work I've done, first and foremost, front and center is story-driven, character-driven movement that does not rely on turns and kicks. It should be extremely visual and innovative, out of the box. I don't like doing stuff in the theater right now that I have seen before. So I'm not interested in sort of recreating great works of Robbins and these styles that you have sort of seen before. I don't need to be doing that right now.
So let's talk a little bit about the television. And right now you're working on Best Time Ever, which is a variety show led obviously by Neil, and it's live. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the show and what you're doing on it.
Well, I am, I'm the choreographer of any of the dance elements they have on the show, but I'm also a producer on the show. It's the first time that I've had that title. So there are six segments, live segments in the show, and we are kind of all hands on deck to make sure that that happens. We have celebrities that show up at the last second on the show. I'm in charge of kind of wrangling them, explaining to them what they're going to do, pitching them the ideas to make sure that they want to do them. We have a big performance at the end of every single show where Neil will perform with an existing group of people. I can't give away who's coming on the show, but it's a very incredible season that we've lined up. So for that specifically, I go to that group, I look at what they have. We don't want one of their numbers that they do normally, so we're taking what they can do and creating a one-of-a-kind moment and number for them to do on our show that has to include Neil, also has to include Nicole Scherzinger, who is a co-host on the show, every single guest that's been on the show that night, and Little MPH. So there's a lot of moving pieces. You don't get any of those people until the day of the show. And then you have to kind of fit them all into the puzzle very quickly. It is so fast-paced that you're coming up with stuff on the fly during the live show, you know, trying to get everything to just happen magically for that one moment. And I've done a lot of live TV work, but nothing that is on this scale. It's kind of crazy how large this show is. We're only done 2 episodes. I've had about 7 anxiety attacks already from the 2 hours on TV. But it really, it's unlike anything else, and the rush that I get from that, I can't match it. So, yeah, it's exciting. I can't wait to see how people, we just had our 2nd episode last night, and I think people are finally understanding what the show is. No one knew what to expect last week, and they spent half the show thinking, what the hell am I watching? But I think that we found our rhythm last night, and I'm excited to keep going with it.
And how different is it creating a dance piece for television, whether it's on So You Think You Could Dance, or Dancing with the Stars, or Best Time Ever, as opposed to theater, where you know the audience has one view, and it's a flat, so that proscenium stage, and here you've got cameras. So how different is it in the composition process for you?
When you do TV, the only thing that matters is what the camera sees. I think in camera shots, even in my theater work, which is something I can't stop my brain from doing now. But yes, when I create on So You Think You Can Dance, I know what every single moment is going to be shot like. You film it on a flip camera and you give it to the director and they put their own spin on it. But if I have 10 really important moments that need to be filmed a certain way, they make that happen. We have a lot of control on So You Think You Can Dance as to what we say, how the lights are going to be, what the costumes are, the hair, the camera shots, every single element we essentially do direct and produce. I can't have that much control on when I do the big award shows or Best Time Ever, because there's so much. There's 19 cameras and they're in the live booth calling them, and you sort of have to create and make sure, just like you do on stage, that everything looks good. But I had these incredible dancers on the show last night to dance with Bonnie Tyler. Half of what they do gets cut out because they're close-up shots and they're here and there, and you have to just let that go and know that, you know, okay, well, we worked really hard on that moment that didn't matter at all because nobody saw it, and you can't take that personally. You really have to move on to the next step. But when you do theater, yeah, it's not such a pinpointed vision of what you would like to be seen. You have to know that the audience can look anywhere they want, and then it's your job to try to hone in their focus to exactly what needs to be seen. I really like working in both forms of, you know, in both mediums, but they are very different, obviously.
So you've obviously been involved with Broadway for a long time now. Since you were a kid, you've seen a lot of changes in the industry. How has dance and choreography changed over the last 23 years since you've been doing it?
Well, it's gotten a lot harder. What people can do has gotten a lot harder. I think in the same way that if you look at the Olympics 20 years ago, what they were doing in gymnastics and ice skating was so far below where they're at right now. You think, what physically could anybody else do with their bodies? But we've come a long way in that aspect. Even on So You Think You Can Dance, what the show was doing 10 years ago, those big numbers and big moments would not be considered anything. They would be considered kind of, you know, bombs at this point, because we've pushed ourselves so far. So I'm extremely excited to be having my career in this moment where dance is really, really strong, where it's all over the place, where people are recognizing dancers as not celebrities, but as personalities as well. Nobody knew a dancer from another dancer back 10, 15 years ago. But now the dancers that are coming out of the TV shows, they have their own followings and their own groupies and hundreds of thousands of followers. And that's a little strange and a little different. In the same way that a choreographer that my face is on that TV show and I could get stopped on the street daily with people saying that they love this number, that they like this, that didn't happen to choreographers 10 years ago. They were faceless. another thing is that I think the American audience has gotten schooled in what is good dancing and what is not. So you can't put mediocre dancing in front of them anymore because they've watched all these shows and learned these comments from judges and are able to form their own opinions, and their tastes have gotten heightened as well. So I think the entire industry has just had to raise the bar.
So let's talk about Spring Awakening a little bit. How did this come about for you?
I had worked with Michael in LA on some other shows. We knew each other in New York when we were both performers. We had both moved out to LA and were sort of craving theater because there isn't a whole lot out there. And Michael is really good at wrangling people to do stuff for free and to just like come and have a good time and do this reading in my living room, or let's put on this crazy play that goes to six locations in Silver Lake where the audience has to go on public transportation. That was the first thing we did. It was nuts. But I've always had a good time working with him. He dreams really, really big, and I enjoy trying to make those things a reality for him. So he came to me with this. I had never seen Big River. I'd never seen the Death West show. I knew what it was. I had never really signed or had any inclination as to what that would be like. And we did a workshop 2 years ago. It was, from the first second, terrifying, hard. Any trick or, you know, normal rehearsal process that I'd ever used in my life just didn't work. And so I kept trying things that just weren't working and trying to incorporate with the sign language and hitting a brick wall with the ASL interpreters as to what we could do, what we couldn't do. And every day was, you know, I would get in my car at the end of the day of the workshops and like want to cry because it was so frustrating. But then there would be these moments during the day where you would see these glimmers of hope of what the show might be. And it was impossible to not get chills watching them. So I knew it was really special. We had planned on doing 5 or 6 songs in that workshop. We got 2 done, which showed us how long everything was going to take. And then the workshop ended and people came and saw it. Everybody was in tears, and then I let it go. And a year passed and we came upon the 99 Seat Theater, and every single thing that could have gone wrong leading up to that went wrong. And I just kept expecting Michael to throw in the towel, because I would have. Any normal sane person would have said, we're not supposed to do this right now. We lost our theater. We lost half of our cast. We lost our stage managers. We lost our money, up until just a few days before rehearsal started. So I was at the same time directing another show and doing So You Think You Can Dance when Spring Awakening was supposed to go into rehearsals. And I just remember always thinking, this isn't really going to happen. It's not going to happen. And then it did. And we went into rehearsal and I found myself working from 5 or 6 in the morning until midnight every day on those 3 projects, doing TV show in the morning, directing play in the afternoon, coming to Spring Awakening at night. And the first week of Spring Awakening, I came so close myself to throwing in the towel because I was physically exhausted, and it was launching back into this world that was so incredibly difficult to communicate. Our cast was brand new. We really didn't have any of our workshop cast. So you had the hearing kids on one side of the room and the deaf kids on the other side of the room, and nobody was talking to each other, and there was so much tension in the room, and it was really, really scary for everybody. And we just kept kind of pushing on and seeing those glimmers of hope, rehearsing in this horrible church rec room in the valley. And everybody was coming for free, trucking it in there and spending these hours. And it was, I think every single person had the same thought that they wanted to quit because it was really, really hard. But at the same time, you couldn't stop it. It had us. So that went on for 2 months. I mean, it was the longest rehearsal process ever. We could get half a number done every day because it just took so long. And Michael and I were, throwing, in an organized way, throwing spaghetti at the wall, just trying to see what would work, what we could do that looked impressive. You can't use counts. You can't rely on musicality. Everything had to be visual. And how do you make 2.5 hours out of sign language not look like 2.5 hours of people standing there signing? And every time we'd find a new idea that worked, it was like, oh my God, okay, this is really cool. Okay, let's figure out something for the next one. So then we moved to our 99 Seat Theater, and when we made the move and we got into that new space, the show really started to come alive. We all had this fear, I think, that we just weren't going to be able to pull it off or that nobody would come. I remember really thinking, how are we going to get 99 people a night to come to this thing? It was shocking to just think that anybody would care or want to come see it. And just from the very first preview, the buzz and the people's reactions, crying afterwards, coming up to us, hugging, it was nice to know that being that inundated in it and having no idea of people's reactions would be that strong. So we just instantly sold out. I remember wanting all these people to go see it, and I couldn't get tickets for anybody to come see it. And it was just, all of that was a shock and a surprise. And I think in that moment we knew that wouldn't be the end. But I didn't know, certainly none of this was on the table. You know, when we first started doing it, Michael talked about, well, maybe we can go on a tour, or maybe we, you know. But it had just been here in New York. So I'm like, who would be crazy enough to put us back on Broadway?
I had no idea who would do such a thing.
Thank you. But that, yeah, it just wasn't a reality. It wasn't something that was part of the goal, which is why I think this is a really sweet moment in time, because it's just the icing on the cake and the reward for some really hard work that was just supposed to be for the love of theater.
Now, the original production obviously had some iconic choreography, the Bill T. Jones stuff. Did that go into your mind too? Were you like, did it make you more nervous when you know there's something associated with the show that people remember and know?
It didn't, mainly because I saw the original show once in previews. I was doing another show at the time. I went on like when they had a Sunday night or something, you know, early on in the previews. I remember thinking, this choreography is so cool. I hope this guy gets nominated for this. And then, of course, he went on to win. But you see a show once. I remember that it was very gestural-based, but I didn't remember much more than that. And I very specifically stayed away from him watching any clips. I did the same thing when I choreographed Hedwig. I didn't ever see the original Hedwig because I was, like, 12 years old. But I never went back and looked at YouTubes because I thought, if I come upon the same thoughts and ideas that were there before in my own right, then that's what they're meant to be. But I know that I'm not influenced by what was happening before. And then if I come up with something that's so wild and radically different, I'm not going to worry about doing that because it's so different. It just left it as like a blank slate and left it for me as just a new musical. So no, it didn't worry me. The only thing that I thought was that it was very based in gestures, and I had talked to some of the original cast who, you know, they would find, what does this mean to you? What would this word mean? Find a gesture for that. Well, we sort of had the same thing, but it actually was a language, and it actually were gestures that were being provided by our ASL team. And I think that's the similarity, and, you know, but that was my main focus, was obviously taking that huge part of it and not worrying about what Bill T had done.
Well, I did see the original Hedwig, and I remember going to the production here and being a little bit nervous because I love that production so much. And I think people that see originals feel that a lot of times about revivals. Oh, is it going to be different than the original? We loved it. And what I loved about your work in Hedwig is that it was everything about the original and then some on this giant stage, but obviously new and different and unique to your vision. And the same thing with Spring. What I love about the show, actually, is, and what I think you've done such a great job with, halfway through the show, I forget that the cast is deaf. Talk a little bit about those cues that they, because I forget that they can't hear the music, which I'm just going to repeat that to everyone out there, because we've been talking about it like, oh yeah, it was difficult, it was long. The thing that makes it difficult in a long rehearsal process is that many of the cast members can't hear a thing. So how are they getting those cues? Tell us a little bit about those Easter eggs in the show.
Yeah, the part of the show that the audience will never be aware of is by far the most complicated part. And the goal is exactly what you said, that you are supposed to become unaware of it, you know, 20, 30 minutes into the show. I think it's like watching a foreign movie where in the first 10, 15 minutes, you're incredibly aware of the subtitles and then they go away and you're just, you know, receiving it. I love that about our show in the first place, that it takes 15, 20 minutes to get going because you're really trying to figure it all out and it's a puzzle. And then I think the show really blossoms in bitch, and then you get rocketed. But there are, yes, so everything is actor driven, is cue driven on stage. So if there is a phrase of music and a deaf actor is starting to sign, then a hearing actor standing next to them will fold their arms or unfold their arms or shift their body weight or just simply look at the actor. And then the four counts later, when the next phrase looks, they shift their body weight the other way. So there are thousands of these throughout the show. And then there's just a lot of kind of breathing as one company and in formations, making sure that there are sort of hearing anchors planted throughout so that deaf actors always have somebody hearing in their eyesight to sign along with. And then just after months of repetitive rehearsal with the rhythms of the signs and they just have that internal cues in their body. It really was repetition and then, you know, there's a lot of people do viewpoints, and it's interesting because we certainly didn't do viewpoints with this cast, but it is very much the same kind of feelings and ideas. And it's like when we all sit together. When we all stand, we can see that, we can feel that as a company. And it just sort of became subconscious in my mind as well over the years of working with this company. I just started to learn, like, what we can and can't do. And there's no such thing as, so everybody's going to stand on the one. So we got 5, 6, 7, 8, 1. It doesn't work like that. It's like, so the three of you are going to watch Allie and she's going to shrug her shoulders on the 7. And then you, on the 8, you wait a beat and then you stand on the 1. And you three over there are going to watch Catherine and she points her finger out from her fist on the 8 and that's your cue, you know. So it's constant running around and creating all those cues and making sure everybody has what they need. And then you just have to do it 10 times to get everybody to stand on the 1. So that's a lot of what the time is. And then I look and I want to change something and you think, do I have the hour to change this one moment? Does it mean that much to me to change this? Or do I need to worry about something else? So thankfully through the 3 times we've done this now, I've gotten to fix a lot of the things that I've wanted and I have my list and I look at it now and I still have 10 things I want to change and I have to decide in our last couple days of rehearsal what are the really important ones to do because it's not just you all sit around in a group setting and I give a note and I say, hey everybody, let's just do this instead. Like it doesn't work like that. The extra hard work that we put in on the front end of the rehearsal process, I just think is so shown. The reward is so great. Because when the show's over, you do stop and you think, wait, how did they do that? How are they all perfectly in time at all, you know, at all times? And it's because I screamed at them for months until they were.
God, that has to be the most frustrating part for you. Because obviously, look, you were arranging rocks as a kid. You were a perfectionist that likes the patterns. You want things to go a certain way. And putting a show on Broadway is so difficult in the last few weeks because of the constraints of a preview process and the number of hours you can rehearse and the number of things you can change in a regular show. And now you've only got limited because you know it takes hours and hours.
It does. Tech is not fun with this process, mainly because you can't, which I'm sure Michael talked about, you can't really use a god mic in the way that you would normally. He has to say hold, and then TJ hears that, and he has to flash a light, but they're all, you know, mid doing stuff. It takes them all a very 30 seconds to realize we've said hold, and then everybody's got to reset, and they have to stop, and they have to look at the interpreter, who's got a little light on her, and then you run up on stage, and you're trying to, you know, to move people around, because you can't really just sit in the house and say, hey, Trishelle, what number are you on? Like, are you on 2? You know, it's not so easy as that. And then you're running on stage and they're lighting. So you have to find the light so that they can read your lips or they can see you well enough to interpret. And the interpreter's running behind you. And I just want to go fast and fix everything. And she's running alongside trying to sign along. And it's just, you know, you have to just breathe because you want to get so frustrated. And the band members are playing their music really loud and they're sound checking and lights are flashing and you're like, can everything just stand still for 1 second and turn the lights on so I can please tell everybody what I need them to do? But that, you know, it's the same feeling of when you work in like a crazy live TV environment. You just have to take a breath and get it done and know that it's exhilarating to get to do something like that. But the tech process is not my favorite part of working with Deaf West.
Well, it's obvious that you're the right guy for it because of all that television experience and that high pressure. And again, the brilliance for me of the show is that all that hard work and all that stress, and you can't see it at all when you watch the show. It just beautifully blends so well together. What's next for you?
Well, I finished up. Right now, all I can see in life is the next 8 weeks here doing Best Time Ever, producing a brand new, you know, hour of live TV every single week, which takes us to mid-November. And then I go back to LA and do two shows for Nigel Lithgow and his family. They do British pantos they've brought over. So I do two shows simultaneously when I get back to LA, one at Laguna Playhouse and one at Pasadena Playhouse. And then I'm taking the holidays off because I have not stopped this entire year. And then next year it starts all over again with, you know, shows that I have on the docket of the workshops and things. And you know, I don't know if So You Think You Can Dance is coming back again for another year, but that holds about 4 months of my life. But I'm sort of excited that I'm hoping next year will be bigger than ever, and that, you know, Michael and I can do a new show together in some way. But we'll see what comes up after this. We'll see what people's interests in me are after this show goes.
Lots of our greatest directors in the musical theater were choreographers originally, and you mentioned directing a play. Do you want to direct as well?
I do. I absolutely do. I moved very quickly from dance to choreography, and I would like to work. There's a whole list of directors I would like to work with and learn from before I really step out on my own. I've been, you know, a few years ago I was choreographing in the regional world, and now I think I'm choreographing the Broadway world, then I can go back to that regional world and direct there and sort of breed who I want to be as a director in those theaters and then move on. So that's sort of my plan at the moment, and where I'm working regionally is now in the directing field. But I do want to be more like a Rob Marshall in terms of directing the film and the TV. So I think it's just a constant moving up and not leaving a category behind. It's why I'm keeping a foot very firmly in TV and film and theater and moving myself up equally, because I don't think there's another choreographer that's doing that right now that really is at the top of all of those worlds. I would like that to be me.
I have a feeling it's going to happen, and I also have a feeling you won't be directing in the regionals for very long before you get tapped for something much, much bigger. Okay, last question. It's my genie question. I want you to imagine that the genie from Aladdin makes an appearance in front of you and says, Spencer, you've done such great work in television and theater, and I love the revival of Hedwig, and I'm so glad that was back. And the craziness you've gone through with the Deaf West tech, I want to grant you a wish. I want you to think about the one thing that drives you so crazy about Broadway. One thing that keeps you up at night, that makes you so angry. You're such a sweet, nice guy. What drives you nuts? What makes you angry about the world in which you work that you would want this genie to wish away in an instant?
Oh my God, that's a hard one. I'm going to watch my...
And you can't wish for other wishes or anything. You get one wish, the one thorn in your side.
Maybe this sounds awful and a double-edged sword, but it's the quick negativity of the internet world and how easy it is for someone to sit at home and criticize what you're doing and what's going on. I am so sensitive as an artist that I can't look at Twitter, I can't look at the blogs, because I can't, you know, I have to stay removed from that sort of critique, because it hurts. It's like, it's crazy how hurtful it can be for someone to throw a comment that they don't like, you know, that what you're doing is terrible. So I would love to remove the ability for that much negativity to be in the world on your work, so that we can all create in a safer space, and it, you know, when things don't work, they don't work, but it's sort of that, if get in the ring and do it yourself before you can throw those things around, because it's really, really hard. And then, yeah, that would be my wish.
It's a good wish. Thank you so much for taking time out of your very, very busy schedule to spend it with us, and thanks for all the incredible work you're doing. Especially, of course, for me, the work you've done on Spring is so stunning and beautiful and so incredibly fused into everything else. It's a joy to watch. Thanks, all of you, for listening. Next week, Spring Awakening Month ends with the artistic director of Deaf West Theater himself, Mr. DJ Kurz. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening, guys. Don't forget, get on over to iTunes and give us a nice, juicy, favorable review. It'll really help spread the word about what we're doing here. Thanks so much. And if you're not a subscriber, be one. Thanks.
I'm gonna be a producer. Look out, Broadway.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard. So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.